I love what I've termed emotional resonance. I love that sense of resonating with other people. Like when I write a blog post that, I can almost like feel it hitting with other people because it seems to be written from what I call the sweet spot, mm-hmm. Inside myself. And the sweet spot is kind of like this place where who I am kind of merges into, who my audience is. So I'm writing for both myself and other people. And that seems to be where I do my best work and I do my most relevant work.
I'm Srini Rao, and this is the Unmistakable Creative Podcast, where you get a window into the stories and insights of the most innovative and creative minds who've started movements, built thriving businesses, written best-selling books, and created insanely interesting art. For more, check out our 500-episode archive at unmistakablecreative.com. Justine, welcome to the Unmistakable Creative. Thanks so much for taking the time to join us.
Oh, thank you, Srini. It's always great to be talking with you.
Yeah, my pleasure. So it is so cool to have you back here. You know, we had you on the show back when we were called Blogcast FM. You were a speaker at last year's Instigator Experience, and I've always been a very, very huge fan of your work. I mean, you wrote the foreword to my book, which I jokingly say is a tough act to follow. But you know, what prompted me to reach out to you this time was a thread that you replied to on Quora about extreme success, about people like Elon, people like Bill Gates, people like Steve Jobs. Right. But before we get into all of that, for the people who are listening who may not be familiar with you and who you are in your story, can you tell us a bit about your story, your journey, your background, and how that actually led to sort of this unusual view into extreme success that you have?
Oh, okay. Well, I was actually born in a small town in Canada called Peterborough, Ontario, and I grew up there. And I came to writing fiction very young. And I ended up going to Queen's University in Kingston, Ontario, where I met this individual named Elon Musk. And he was an extremely unusual man. I mean, that was apparent right from the beginning. Extremely determined, extremely brilliant. And he had big plans right from the beginning. So we butted heads pretty much from the beginning and then ended up getting married and having kids. And he went on to create a couple of companies, one of which was PayPal. Mm-hmm. And then he went on and he did SpaceX and Tesla. And I wrote some novels that were published, dark fantasy thrillers called, one was called Blood Angel. There was a sequel to that called Lord of Bones. And then there was a young adult supernatural thriller called Uninvited. And they were published by imprints at Simon & Schuster and Penguin. Mm-hmm. And then things happened. We got divorced. And the divorce kind of blew up and became public. And I did some writing about that. And I kind of went through I don't really want to call it an identity crisis, but maybe an identity transition. I was trying to figure out this question of how to best live. Like, what do I want to do with my life and who do I want to be? And I, the nature of my reading changed and I began reading obsessively, partly to answer these questions. And that kind of led me into this online culture of blogs and, online creative entrepreneurial activity and things like that. And I just started, getting really, really curious about what drives people to do what they do. And I started paying attention to certain patterns of personality I was seeing in the world around me. And one thing I eventually started noticing about a lot of the advice that is presented in the self-help world is it just seemed like certain things weren't really being said, and including the role that adversity often plays in the lives of these people who go on to do what they do. And by adversity, I don't necessarily mean that they were born into a war zone and they had to climb out of third world poverty or anything like that. I mean, for the most part, these are individuals who are born into like affluent circumstances, but they're really driven in a way that I noticed early on. And I kind of wanted to explore that. And I wanted to kind of enter that into the conversation a little bit more than I was seeing. So all of this stuff was kind of going on in my mind. And then one day I sat at my computer and I was checking out Quora because I had stopped blogging for a while. I've been actively blogging for years. And I hit a point where I felt like I needed renewal of some kind. And I really wanted to think about what I wanted to write going forward. So I started investigating other social media sites. And I came to Quora.com, which seemed interesting and fun. And I didn't have any kind of presence there. And I just felt that, you know, I could basically answer any of these questions or just explore new topics. And one day when I sat down, I came across this question. I don't even think it was on Quora.com. I think I saw it on Facebook somewhere. And it was about how do I become great? Like Elon Musk, Richard Branson, Steve Jobs, Bill Gates. And it was written by a young computer student or a student in computer programming. And I thought, okay, well, I'll just sit down and I'll write a few lines in answer to this and try to get across that that this is it's an extreme way to go about life to come from this kind of perspective. And I kind of went into the zone and seriously like lost track of time and really enjoyed answering this question. And then when I came out of this, I found that like about an hour at least had passed and I'd written this long answer and I posted it. And that kind of started the ball rolling. I mean, it got attention from the beginning. It didn't blow up until, you know, some weeks later after I'd answered a companion question to that. And then I just watched it. It was like a snowball, you know, rolling down the mountain and getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And I just kept waiting for it to die, and it didn't. And it's been fascinating to watch the reaction.
Hmm. All right. So there's a lot of stuff here. You know, I want to go to the beginning of this and talk really about sort of that moment of identity crisis and the questions that you wrestled with and, you know, what those questions were. Mm-hmm. Is an identity crisis necessary to sort of transform into who we're ultimately destined to become? And if so, how do we bring it about?
I don't think we necessarily have to try to bring it about, because I think life has a way of bringing it about for us. that's the thing about, you know, crisis. Crisis has a way of shattering all the structures that we've built for our lives. And, you know, complacency is forced to go out the window because suddenly you get to a point where nothing in your life is working. And so you kind of have to, clear away the debris and start over. And then when you're at that point, you can start asking yourself questions that you could not afford to ask yourself before. And then when you ask yourself different questions, that directs you to think in different ways, which can produce different answers. And then that can show you a side of yourself that you didn't even know was there. And then you can build something really, really interesting from that.
Hmm. So what were the questions that you were wrestling with after the divorce?
The questions I was wrestling with. That's a good question. I feel a little bit. I think it was mostly about how to live a meaningful life. I mean, I was in a unique position. I have 5 kids, but I was in, you know, very privileged circumstances. So I had, and then I also had 50-50 custody. So I was looking at a life that was, you know, half with the kids and then half without the kids. And it was a question of how do I create something and how do I build the kind of life for my family that I want when I did not get the family that I necessarily expected, you know what I mean, in terms of the complete family unit. And also, too, the circumstances were extreme, you know, to use that word extreme again, because, you know, this is really not a normal life. Mm-hmm. So it was And then there was that question too of, you know, coming out from the shadow of that kind of marriage with such a prominent individual. It was a good question to ask myself, you know, who am I really? And where do I really want to go in terms of, I'm sorry, I'm rambling here.
No, not at all. Keep going. This is great.
Well, it was, an interesting time, and it was, you know, and sometimes too, it's, I tend to operate by, feeling a lot. And so often I eventually learned that my intuition operates in terms of, you know, hunches and feelings, not necessarily, images and definitely not words. And so I was actually, driven to go online, and I was driven to, explore the online world. And I discovered like this incredible opportunity to communicate with people that, you know, had not existed even a few years before. And so here I am, I'm a writer, and I have access to this incredible technology, and I can reach people. And so what do I want to say? And what kind of message do I really want to spend my time getting across to people? Like what can I contribute that way? So it was a lot of deep diving into different topics and trying to find the things that connected with me that also connected to other people. And it's, you know, it's kind of like that part in the hero's journey where the hero is like wandering through the wilderness and you know, finding berries here and finding clues there and, you know, gradually putting together enough information that will get you to the other side.
You know, it's interesting because I had a feeling you might bring up that idea of the shadow of you know, such a prominent marriage. And I guess the question for me is, in our own lives, when we're dealing with shadows of that mm-hmm. sort, maybe not as big as yours, but they're absolutely there. How do you come out of the shadows and into your own? Does that make any sense at all?
it absolutely makes sense. I think it's probably a little bit different for men and women, you know, in a different but equal sense, in that, like, as girls and women, we are encouraged to define ourselves in relationship to other people, whereas you know, men are generally encouraged to define themselves in relationship to themselves. So it's not like I can say I went into this marriage as like a fully formed individual. Like, it's not like I knew who I really was back then. Mm-hmm. So it was, and then when you get swept up in somebody else's world the way I did, you know, not because the other person is like trying to subsume you, but it's just kind of how things happen. Then when that world, you know, goes on and you're no longer part of it, it kind of throws you back on yourself in a lot of ways. So I think it's just a question of looking at what's right in front of you and paying a lot more attention to what's going on inside you, like learning to tune in to that intuitive voice. And I became I've become a very strong believer in the power of that inner voice. And I think, you know, all of us, both men and women, we are encouraged in many ways to disconnect from that voice. And so I think a key part of figuring out who you really are, especially when you are coming back from a place that is, you know, where you were thrown off center, it's just learning to recognize those hunches and those feelings and those yearnings and, you know, the things that you project onto other people that are actually your own unclaimed material and what they say about you. And so it's kind of like reading your life like it's a mystery novel and looking for the clues to what you really want to do, which is a sign of who you really are. Mm-hmm. And it's just a patient, painstaking process of figuring it out. I mean, it really is a quest. And I think we can go about the quest unconsciously, or we can go about the quest, you know, with a lot of intention and a lot of purpose and a lot of desire. And that really makes a difference in whether you enjoy that process or not. And since we're kind of committed to it, whether or not we want to be, we might as well enjoy it.
Wow. That was profound.
I didn't really know where I was going there, but I hope I made a point.
Yeah, no, you definitely did. Let me ask you this.
Okay.
One of the things that you brought up was that answering that thread on Quora was effectively a process of creative renewal.
It was part of it, yeah.
And I'm interested in how we start to find whatever it is in our own lives that will enable renewal.
I think you have to start with what's already working. You know, I think we have a natural built-in inclination to always focus on the negative. We have that instinct that was built in for survival purposes. I mean, you know, we have to notice what the problems are so we can fix them, so we can continue to survive. But in the modern day world, the problems that are going to reach out and grab our attention are not matters of life and death. They're going to be matters about, like, getting out that email in time, or making that deadline, or making sure the kids get to soccer practice in time, or figuring out what you're going to, like, cook for dinner. So to kind of, like, step away from all that busyness and to carve out time just to think can be a massive effort and something that you have to go about deliberately. So I think in the beginning, it's a lot to just schedule in like 30 minutes every day where you're just going to sit in a quiet room by yourself and you're going to think. Maybe, and writing in a journal I've found to be incredibly helpful. I don't even like to call it a journal, because a journal makes it sound like it's this ongoing organized activity. I would just do a lot of free writing on, like, spare sheets of paper, or just do this brain dump and find out what was in my head. And so when you do that, when you start to work on getting what's inside of your head, you know, outside, when you're trying to manifest it in some physical form, that forces you to follow your thought process a lot more deeply than you do when you're just in your head. And it shows you things that you didn't think you knew, and that can surprise you. And so that can reveal a lot about yourself to yourself. And then when you look at the parts of your life where you feel good, or you know, where you're happy, where you're most fulfilled, when you look at what's really working, whether it's you know, your family life, or the kids, or this hobby that you're doing, or this thing that really fulfills you. Like if you start dissecting that a little bit and figuring out what it is about that works for you, what activity or what talent in you that seems to be tapping into. I discovered that I have I love what I've termed emotional resonance. I love that sense of resonating with other people. Like when I write a blog post I can almost, like, feel it hitting with other people, because it seems to be written from what I call the sweet spot, mm-hmm. Inside myself. And the sweet spot is kind of like this place where who I am kind of merges into who my audience is. So I'm writing for both myself and other people. And that seems to be where I do my best work. And I do my most relevant work, and it's the most satisfying feeling. So I thought, okay, well, I want more of that in my life. How do I get more of that? And so that was kind of a starting place for me. Hmm.
You think that ability to create emotional resonance with an audience is something that is inherently built into certain creative people, or is it something that can be learned? And if so, how?
That's a good question. You know, we all have it. We all have it, because creative expression is about communication. It's about connection. That's how we, we need to connect with people, and we need to create community. And we want to know and be known, and we can't be known by other people if we don't show them who we are. And so when we can make something out of nothing and we can put it into the world and we can do it in a way so that it has meaning for other people and not just for us, you know, when there's skill and there's craft involved, then we are showing the world who we are. And that enables other people to, you know, connect with us through the work. And when the work resonates with who they are because they bring their own meaning to it, then that's taken this private experience and it's you know, blown it up into a much larger story, and it's woven it into a much larger story about who we are as a tribe, you know, as a culture, as you know, even as a ongoing story of humanity itself. So it's a really, really powerful thing. And coming back to this idea that we all have it, you know, we're all creative. I think some of us just get, for whatever reason, some of us are more obsessed about it than others, maybe because our brains work a little bit differently. I mean, creativity is often linked, high creativity is often linked with, you know, with depression, with mood disorders, with ADD, with just a different way of processing experience. You know, stimuli kind of like bombards you. And instead of dealing with it, you know, one at a time, like, I don't know, I'll call them like neurotypical people, it kind of all sloshes around in your head, which allows you to make unique relationships, or which allows you to make unique connections between things and see relationships between things. And that can create new insights and ideas. And so when these ideas work, you know, you're being very creative. And when they break down and they don't work, then you're, you know, you're in a psych ward somewhere. So that thin line between, you know, madness and creativity, it's definitely there. And I definitely do believe that very creative people can be, maybe sometimes live a little bit closer to it than others. But we all have that need to reach out across this abyss, you know, how it feels sometimes, and make contact with people who are, you know, living in the reality that is outside of the reality that we project onto reality, if you know what I mean, if I'm not getting too meta here. So it's like we all walk around in our own little worlds. And so to kind of like reach through that world and make contact with somebody else who's like living in their world. I mean, when you think about it, it's actually not a small thing, and it's so rife with miscommunication and misperception and prejudice and bias and all of those things, and you know, suppressed emotion and baggage from the past, and that rises up to interfere with that connection. So it's like it's just something that we constantly have to work at, and that's one thing that artists are really, really driven to do.
Well, I think that makes a perfect setup to sort of shift gears and get into the meat of why I wanted to have this conversation today. You mentioned that right when you met Elon, you could see that he had big plans. Mm-hmm. And what I want to talk about is the psychology of a person like this and the evolution of a person like this. From where he was when you met him to all the things we kind of know him for today. And what is it that is, what makes a person like that tick, I guess, is really the question. And how do they evolve to the level that he has?
I think, like that's kind of the question, isn't it? It's, you know, he is, I have often described him as a black swan individual, sorry. Yeah, because he's you don't often meet people like him, and he comes at the world in a different way. And I'm not gonna like psychoanalyze him or anything like that. Sure. I mean, you know, like he is who he is, and I want to celebrate that. But he just has a way of taking this vision in his head and imposing it on the world around him until the world around him becomes like the world in his head. Like, and he doesn't seem able to live in any other kind of way. So there's a need and a drive in him that is so compelling that it defines his life. And it's so compelling that it draws other people into it too. So, and he's always been like that. So there's a personality at work there, a dynamism mm-hmm. that I do not think that you can learn or acquire, because I think it's either in you or it's not. But whatever it is in you, I mean, you can cultivate that to the most of your ability, and you can do that through learning who you are and learning what your strengths are and learning what your weaknesses are and learning how to apply them to the world in a way that answers a need that the world has. And I think that, you know, Elon is very gifted in knowing how to do that. He's always had a very instinctive drive for that and for how he wants to do that. And he always, you know, he always believed it was possible. He always had this tremendous sense of optimism that he could go forth into the world and he could, he could solve these huge, massive problems and create something that was really interesting for himself and for a lot of people. And he never wavered in that belief. So it was just an incredible level of conviction that you just do not come across in that many people. So, and then when I noticed that in him, I also started noticing that in other people who have become major figures in the culture or in the past. They have an extremely bold point of view, and what's more, they're completely driven by it, and they're convinced of it. Like they don't doubt it, and they don't allow other people to they don't allow the doubts that other people inevitably have to contaminate their own belief in it. So it's I think when you have that, then it has a way of clarifying your own life to you. So it kind of makes sense that you should do these things and you should not do these things, and it helps you figure out who you should listen to and who you should not listen to, and that can kind of become your your compass, to use one of your words, Srini. Mm.
So what's interesting to me is that you said this is something that you're either born with or you're not, which I happen to think there's a grain of truth to that.
Like, but I don't want to get all deterministic, like I'm sure. Not saying, but the thing is, I think most of us are all like we're all born with some degree of that.
Uh-huh.
So there's something there that is innate, and it's not a question of reading books about how do I become like this, so much as kind of going inward and figuring out how you already are like that, and learning how to develop that part of who you naturally are instead of trying to make yourself into somebody that you are not.
So let's talk about that. And that's actually where I wanted to go with this. So you kind of, read my mind. I love this idea of such bold conviction, cultivating dynamism, or however you say it. And really sort of this part of us that is innately inside of us. I mean, how do we push it to the limits that we are capable of, even if we're not going to, solve the kinds of problems that people like Elon, people like, Richard Branson, and people like Steve Jobs solve? And can you make that quantum leap if you are just somebody who, in a moment might seem average? Or are you just destined for that?
Well, I mean, nobody's really average in terms of, we all are. I'm thinking about that line in Fight Club. What is it? It's like, you are not a freaking snowflake, or you're not a unicorn. We are snowflakes, in that we're all, we all have that unique soul print, and we all have this unique, crazy mix of talents and abilities. And I think one thing I noticed about people like Richard Branson or the Google guys or Elon or let's get some women in here, Gloria Steinem, Coco Chanel, all of those people, is that they all reach this extreme level of success, and they're all visionaries, and they all have these really bold points of view, but they're not cookie cutter in any way. They all have such a unique path to success, and I really think that comes down to understanding who you are and what works for you and what doesn't work for you, and learning how to steer yourself in the direction of your strengths. And so I think it's just, instead of creating this 5-year plan and then imposing it on yourself when you are still learning who you are in terms of whether or not you're actually going to fit into that plan. I think there has to be an element of, experimentation mm-hmm. right from the beginning in small ways, little bets, like yep. Peter Sims writes about, and then just leaning into what works and leaning into what works and leaning into again what works and being open to what's going on around you, which is, I think only more important as the rate of change speeds up and we head into an increasingly complex and interconnected world. And being really mindful of the system that you're in mm-hmm. and noticing how what you do resonates with other people or it doesn't resonate. And then just, constantly course correcting and constantly adapting and really enjoying the process. And we live in a culture that puts so much emphasis on product and puts, so much emphasis on external rewards. And then all of these studies have come out studying what truly motivates us. And then it turns out that when we are motivated by the end product, we actually do a lesser quality of work than when we're, in love with the process. Mm-hmm. So, and one thing in my own life I've really had to work to get is a more moment by moment appreciation of what I'm actually doing in terms of, enjoying this step and doing this step and then going on to the next step and enjoying that step and then doing the next step. Like just doing it like a bird by bird by bird way, as Anne Lamott writes about. Paying attention to each brick and where that brick is going and how that's affecting, the larger picture of the wall itself.
Wow. There's so much here. I mean, this is hands down been my favorite part of the conversation. You've just dished one gold nugget after another. One thing that really struck me that you said about these sort of visionary people is this idea of an unwavering commitment and conviction mm-hmm. About the things that they believe. Mm-hmm. And I'm asking this for very selfish and personal reasons because I've had moments where I have doubted my own conviction and commitment to my own journey. And I'm wondering how I can cultivate an unwavering commitment no matter what the external circumstances seem to indicate.
Well, I think it probably, comes down to how you're defining that internal vision. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I think like doubt plays an incredibly important role in, how we discover truth and how we build on truth. And so I wouldn't want to say that you should have this total sense of invulnerability, mm-hmm. this sense that, what I believe is like the ultimate authority on everything. It's a dance between having the confidence in yourself to move forward and then a confidence in your ability to learn new steps and to learn where the dance is going to take you. So maybe that's it. The conviction comes down to something more fundamental than just, I want to go forth and I want to build this kind of company or I want to write this kind of novel. It's having a faith in your own uniqueness as a person and your own drive to manifest that uniqueness in the world in a way that serves both the world and yourself, like defining that sweet spot. So when you believe that sweet spot exists, when you have unwavering faith that sweet spot is there, then you're never going to give up looking for it. But when you decide, well, it's not there and this is the best I can do for myself and this is the most that I, will probably get in this life and so I should settle for this and be reasonable and be practical and keep doing what I'm doing, even though what I'm doing is like killing me slowly. I think that's an easier path to take for a lot of people. And I think that's the path that this culture hands us in a lot of ways, partly because when we are unhappy, we tend to, buy a lot more crap that we don't need. So in a lot of ways, the culture kind of runs on that. So having faith in your ability to create your own path without starving to death.
Do you think there's something that separates the people who find the sweet spot and choose it from the ones who ignore it willfully?
Well, I think when you look at people like Elon and Richard and others, and this was a point that comes up repeatedly when people talk about the piece or criticize the piece, it's you know, these people tend to be from privileged circumstances. I mean, they tend to be white male and Western, and generally from you know, middle class, upper middle class, that kind of background. So they're put in a system that works for them. Mm-hmm. And that, I mean, you know, that doesn't take away from the obsessive amount of work that they still do and the courage that, and the courage that they have to take the risks that they do. And they do risk. I mean, a lot of these people are outsiders in a way. They just become outsiders of a very privileged system that they grew up in. So they have all of those benefits of what they grew up with. And then they take that out into the world. And they apply to more rebellious purposes, and so they're able to like change the structure of the culture, partly because they have such an intimate understanding of how that structure works. So so there's that. But I'm sorry, what was the question again?
No, I mean that answered. I mean, do you think there's something that separates the people who find the sweet spot and choose to follow it versus those who willfully, you know, ignore it or do nothing about it?
But then, like, the thing is that my personal heroes tend to be people, I was just talking about this with somebody else, and the two people I mentioned, because I'm particularly fascinated with both of them, David Bowie and Susan Sontag. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Susan Sontag is like this super cool, interesting, awesome, intellectual, but who completely invented herself. Like, she did not grow up in the kind of environment that you would expect to produce somebody who became one of the major intellectual icons of the 20th century. Mm-hmm. But, you know, she did. She used the power of her fascinations and her imagination, and also this sense that she, that the way that she was growing up and the world that she was growing into was not the world that she wanted to create for herself. And so she just kind of went her own way, and she managed to change the world around her to fit the person that she knew inwardly to be. And then she had this incredible, what I think is a fascinating, incredible life. Mm. And then, you know, David Bowie, same thing, like working class background. So he was not supposed to be he was not supposed to dominate the world. You know, he didn't have those things going for him, but he forged the world according to his vision of it. And when I say, you know, the world, I mean the world that we live in, the world that we move through. We're all, in a sense, creating our own world. And some people just go about it a lot more deliberately and skillfully than others. Hmm.
So here's a question. You brought up adversity in the beginning of this conversation. And mm-hmm. So I have two questions around this, really. One is, what misperceptions do people have about extreme success? And I'd love to hear your thoughts on also the role that adversity plays in reaching extreme success.
I'm glad you brought up adversity because, I mean, the thing about a Quora answer is that it's not going to be particularly in-depth. It's so I kind of like glanced over some different points in that answer. And when I said adversity, I was referring more to a sense of, you know, being a square peg. Mm-hmm. And so these are people who, they're odd ducks for the most part. And they're unable to conform, I think, in some way. Not necessarily because they don't want to conform, although I think a lot of them just don't want to. But there's something in their personality that keeps them apart from, you know, from other people. And one thing that has struck me is that for all the ways we talk about, you know, think different and we celebrate the creative rebels and all of that, but when you're a kid and you're different, you know, you get hell for it. Like, kids are not nice to kids that don't fit in or that don't seem to have you know, the kind of interest in I don't want to use the word the herd, but you kind of know what I mean. Who don't go along with the pack. the way that other kids feel they should. And so, you know, these are the kids who are scapegoated and they're bullied. And because on some level, we distrust difference. We're not comfortable with it. So when you find yourself on the other side of that, well, generally, you're alone a lot. So if you're a kid and you're different and you don't have a lot of friends, then you're going to be, you know, in your room a lot, and you're kind of forced to fall back on your own interests and your own obsessions, which means you have the perfect opportunity to find out what they are and then to really dedicate yourself to them. So, I mean, you know, Bill Gates was hacking at 13. And so by the time he got to college, he was already pretty fully formed as a programmer. Like, he had this perspective that a lot of people don't get until they're considerably older than that. And so when you get that kind of head start at a young age, that just only accumulates over time. So, I'm sorry, what was the question?
Well, we were talking about adversity. Yeah. And
adversity,
misperceptions that we have of these people.
Well, that's it. Getting back to adversity, like, and so when I say adversity, I mean some kind of oddness in your personality that keeps you apart from other people, and then you kind of have to figure out a way to use that oddness to your advantage, so that and or even finding a way to connect to other people through that oddness. So, you know, maybe you're not the most social person in the world, and you're not going to be really comfortable with relating to people on that emotional level, but you can create this software that will enable them to, you know, deepen the emotional connections they have with family members who are living half a world away. Hmm. You know, so you can find ways to add to other people's lives by taking advantage of your unique perspective and your unique talents.
Wow. So what would you say are the misperceptions that we have of this, just based on, you know, what the media shows us?
One thing I noticed is that people don't quite seem to appreciate the amount of labor that goes into these kinds of accomplishments. I mean, we talk about work ethic, but it's one thing to have this general sense of, oh, somebody like Elon must work hard, but then to you know, be up close to it and to see it is another thing entirely. And it's just it's so beyond the pale that I think it's hard for most people to relate to. I mean, this kind of work ethic is it really does define your life, and it not only requires sacrifices from you, but also from the people around you. And so I think that, you know, I don't think people have a visceral sense of how intense that kind of lifestyle is, and how driven these people are, and how hard they work, and the level of stress that they deal with. Like, just all of that, partly because it's not really glamorous or sexy or fun to talk about. And we also have such an emphasis on positivity in this culture, on thinking positive and speaking positive, that we kind of shy away from these darker topics. And I don't think that really helps anybody, because I don't think, you know, I don't think you can prepare for difficult times ahead if you are not willing to admit that there are going to be them, you know, if they're not going to exist in the first place. And also, too, it's these darker times that teach you things that you really need to know in order to get to where you want to be.
You know, I really appreciate that you brought that up, because it's interesting. I have been seeing a willingness from people at very high levels to start talking about this. There's a podcast called Reboot, which is done by a venture capitalist named Jerry Colonna, who's invested in all sorts of things and really successful. I mean, he was partners with Fred Wilson. And it was really interesting for him to actually talk about a suicide attempt. I couldn't believe that he talked about that on a podcast. He told another founder that he had tried to kill himself. And I mean, even Brad Feld has written about this. So I think I think we're seeing a shift to a willingness to talk about it, because I think our unwillingness to talk about it has actually cost us something very dear. In fact, in many cases, actual lives.
Yeah. No, I absolutely agree with that. And I also think it's part of this new culture of you know, transparency and authenticity that the, you know, online culture demands, And because there's such an ongoing conversation now, it's brought us to this point where images on their own, you know, we're not going to be as satisfied with them anymore. I mean, you can put forth the image of yourself as this, you know, invulnerable, perfect, heroic individual. We're not buying that anymore, and we're not going to trust that. So, when people come forward and they talk about those times when, yeah, I mean, I was, I'm like, yes, sure, I'm this strong individual and I can do these amazing things. But, you know, I've had like dark nights of the soul where I seriously considered killing myself. And that's just part of the journey, you know, like those are the nights of the soul that, I mean, you know, they serve a purpose. They kind of bring you face to face with what you're really dealing with. Mm-hmm. And they are, they're like the guardians of this doorway into another world and or into another level of accomplishment. And so if you can like stand face to face with those demons and those guardians and figure out the, you know, the answers to the riddles that will allow yourself to pass through into the next level, then great, that's what you're meant to be doing. And if you don't know those answers, then it just means that you're at the wrong gate and you need to kind of shift course a bit. Hmm.
So you have 5 kids. Do you see any of these tendencies in your kids?
Yes, I do.
What are they like? I mean, what are they like at a, what are early, you know, indications of this sort of extreme personality?
Well, I don't know. I mean, you know, they're still pretty young. I'm not going to say that they're, sure. And they have a unique challenge and having the kind of father that they do. And, uh-huh. And also too, they're growing up in extremely different circumstances than I think either one of us could have imagined uh-huh. when we were their age. So, but there's, I see obsessive focus. I see in one child in particular, an inability to be anything other than what he is. And when he feels that he can't express something inside of himself, or when he feels that he is being shepherded in a direction he does not want, like he will just fight you on that. And he won't do it because he wants to hurt you. He's just doing it because something in him just seems to be trying to survive. So he's a square peg. So, but he's this really, really great, unique kid. Uh-huh. And you know, but he's going to, if the structure doesn't fit him, he is going to burn it down and build his own, because that is the only thing he knows how to do, because that's the only way he's going to survive. So I kind of, you know, see that spirit in him.
Wow.
Yeah, he's also very, very smart. So,
wow, this has been mind-blowingly cool. Probably one of those conversations that I will have to replay like 100 times to get everything out of it. So, I have one last question for you.
Okay.
Especially given that you wrote the foreword to my book, and here we are, almost a year, almost 2 years later.
I loved writing that forward, by the way. So
I can't
thank you for giving me the opportunity. For
that. Oh, that was amazing. It's better than the book.
That is not true, but thank you.
What do you think it is that makes somebody or something unmistakable?
I want to think about that question a moment, because I love that question. You know, we talk a lot about soul, and I think it's interesting to define what we mean by soul. And so I like this idea of soul as like the essence of who you are, you know, this thing that makes you, you. And I think that comes down to some kind of talent or ability that you have. And sometimes you have to, it's kind of like a Russian doll. I mean, it's like one of those nesting dolls where you think, oh, okay, my talent is writing, but it's actually not writing. It's something that gets expressed through writing, but it's something that's inside writing. And so it's like, oh, okay, it's my ability to understand a good story. No, it's inside that ability to tell a good story or to understand a good story. And it has more to do with, it's my need to find that place of resonance with, you know, with other people, like something like that. So you have to kind of like keep driving down to find that, that core. And then when you find that core, you can, figure out how to manifest it in the world in a way that connects you to the world. And so when we talk about soul, I think really soul is kind of that place where what you do is who you are. And so you could say that the whole quest of a lifetime is to both find and create your soul, which is to find and create your place in the world. So I think that is what makes you unmistakable. When you can identify your talent, and then when you can cultivate it, and when you can master the skill set that will allow you to put it out into the world and to serve other people. I mean, that is such an incredibly powerful thing. And I, I'm just like moved by thinking about it and talking about it, because I think really that's what we're all searching for, and not just in our own lives, but we want to see it reflect in the lives of others. And when we do see it, we're incredibly inspired by it.
Amazing. Well, Justine, this has been mind-blowingly cool, and I am really, really glad we got a chance to chat. Like I said, this is, to me, one of those conversations that will have to be replayed 100 times to get everything that you packed into it.
Thank you.
I can't thank you enough for coming and talking about this and sharing some of your insights and your story with our listeners.
Oh, always. Thank you so much.
Yeah, and for everybody listening, we will wrap the show with that. Monday on The Unmistakable Creative.
I can only tell you what I've observed in my experience, and that is that the people who seem to have found themselves or seem to have arrived at a place where they're content with what they're doing and with who they are, they all seem, at least in my experience, to have taken a risk at some point along the line, to have not settled for something that would have been easier to settle for at the moment. Now, I don't know, that seems to apply across the board to a lot of people I know, but the ones who seem happy are the ones who had a sense that even though I'm in a place that I could go with right now, where I could make a future, could make a life, whether this is in terms of a spouse or a job or just a dream, they have a sense that, no, this isn't quite the right thing for me, and I'm willing to experience temporary pain now in the name of the greater good.
We revisit our conversation with author Robert Curzon about the DNA of storytellers.